Good morning, sir, and how are you doing this morning, sir?
Very good, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sir, and just for the, not for the record, but just for my information, what is your name, sir?
William Dabney Faya Jr.
Okay, sir, well, welcome to the Arizona Board of Executive Committee on this beautiful, beautiful day, and we will begin your hearing very shortly, and according to what I believe I have here, is the Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse will serve as your lead, and she will be conducting your hearing, she will be leading your hearing, and then we will go in the next voice that you will hear, and that you will see and hear, will be the Honorable Ms. L. Rittenhouse. So thank you so very much, and welcome again, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, ma'am.
Could you please, again, restate your name, full name for the record, and also your ABC number?
Yes, ma'am. William Dabney Wyatt Jr., ABC number 050200.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for a general parole, which would be 412A, home arrest, or absolute discharge hearing this morning. You became eligible for, or you will become eligible, not too long from now, on November 9th of 2018. I'd like to introduce you to the board. We're lucky that the equipment is working today. Some days it's not, we're not so lucky. But today you can actually see us instead of just hearing us. So if you look to your right, my left, on the far end of the bench there, is the Honorable Louis Quinones. Next to him is the Honorable David Neal. Right next to me in the middle here is our board chairman, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright. Over to my right here is the Honorable Michael Johnson, and my name is Gail Rittenhouse. I'll be the panel lead today.
Yes,
ma'am. So we'll start your hearing with a brief summary. And you can help us fill in information that I don't provide, or I might just verify that some of these facts are correct. Just kind of a factual overview of the case. For some reason I pronounced your name, or I thought of your name as Via. So now that I know it's Via, I'll try not to make the mistake, but I apologize if I do.
No problem, ma'am. Most people do, and I've gotten used to just pronouncing it that way, more or less, but the correct pronunciation is Baya.
It's Baya. I'll do my best, sir. Okay.
So
Mr. Baya is 62 years old, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
62, okay. And he's serving 15 years for the crimes of theft, and there are two counts of that theft. And as I figured here, I think they are running concurrently. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so the two thefts. And then this is also, you had previously, I believe, been paroled from a murder first degree charge, 25 to life for that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so then you're currently on a 412B, which you have already received. All of these offenses occurred the same day, correct, sir?
No, ma'am. There were six total counts in the indictment.
Okay.
Count one, first-degree murder, combined with count two, which was theft,
okay,
occurred on March 14th, 1983.
Okay.
The subsequent four counts occurred on Tuesday, March 15th, 1983, and continued through the end of the week, or actually Thursday of that week.
Okay.
It was a series of using the stolen
credit cards
to make various purchases throughout that week.
Okay. But the original crime then was March 14th.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sir, thank you. How old you were when that happened?
27 years old.
You were 27, okay. All right, and it looks like Mr. Vial was convicted of jury trial on April 25th, 1984, and sentenced on June 6th, 1984. He did appeal, and that was affirmed on June 12th of 1985. Does that all sound correct, Mr. Byer?
Yes, ma'am, it does.
Okay. And I didn't see any other criminal history for you, sir, in my review. Did you have any other criminal history?
No, ma'am, this was my first offense.
Okay, that's kind of what I gathered from your file. It looks like you've done some work while you've been there in prison. You've taken some programming. It looks like I see Thinking for Change, Victim Impact Panel, Cultural Diversity, Masonry Plumbing, some computer classes. Is there anything else that you've taken?
Well, yes, ma'am. I've essentially worked for most of my incarceration through the Work Incentive Pay Program. Uh-huh. I have a long work history, almost 35 years, and have gotten excellent ratings throughout for my work.
Okay. Yes, I do see that. That's reflected in the record that you got mostly fives, rating of five being the highest rating, or an occasional four on your work. So it does look like you've had a good work history. I'm looking at your discipline history, and in all of that time, it looks like you've only received two majors, which is pretty pretty impressive for someone who's been in the prison all that time. And it looks like the most recent discipline you received was in October of 2003, and that was a minor. It was disorderly conduct. I don't know whether that would have been, but it was a minor.
That would be the one where I had signed up for a Columbia House music service, and whenever you sign up for those, you're offered to sign up a friend, and by signing up a friend, I had violated the institutional rules of trading and bartering, because we're not supposed to have any kind of commercial activity between ourselves.
Right, gotcha. Okay, well, that explains that one, so thank you for that. It looks like you, as far as release plans, I saw a couple of different things, but it looks like you are eligible for VA housing. You were in the Navy, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, from 76 to 79?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, well, thank you for your service. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
And you're eligible for VA housing, and you also had planned on Social Security for income.
Well, actually, on the Social Security, I plan to work until I'm no longer physically able, so I won't plan on collecting my Social Security until well into my 60s, if not my 70s.
Okay. And it looks like you've taken the masonry and the plumbing classes. Did you have other work skills, or were you planning to try to find something in those fields, or?
Actually, ma'am, I would like to pursue a career either in the libraries or working at the U of A or the Veterans Administration. I would like to do something where I'm around books, even if it's a bookstore or a book publishing company, as possibly a proofreader, or working in their shipping department. It doesn't matter, as long as I'm around books. That's one of the things I've discovered that I love in here. I would like to use my bachelor's degree that I earned in here, and I do have basic computer literacy skills.
Okay.
Of course, I need a lot of work on that to bring them up to a snuff, but I do know my way around a basic operating system and Microsoft Office.
Okay, well, that's a good start. What was your bachelor's degree? Was it a general studies, or would it have a major, or?
It was a Bachelor of Science with a dual major in History and Literature.
Oh, well, impressive. Okay. History and Literature. Okay. So your love of books, in other words.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir. Okay. Let's see. We have three letters of support for you, sir. And I also want to mention we have 1, 2, 3, We have five people here today supporting you, so I want to make sure they'll have a chance to speak when the time comes. So you do have some support in the room, so that's good news. Let's see. Just a couple more. One thing I do want to mention, I always like to get on the record, we have a letter from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office that's dated September 12th of this year, and it is expressing the Maricopa County Attorney's objection to any parole. We get these letters, so we do have a letter from the county attorney in opposition to any sort of parole. I just want to have hear from you, just kind of what happened at the time of the crime, what was going on in your life, what led up to the event, and then what happened that day, or that week, as you said, it kind of occurred over a period of time. So what happened?
Well, the background of it was that I was in a very rebellious part of my life. I felt an undeserved sense of entitlement. I thought the world owed me something. And I made bad choices. And one bad choice led to a worse one. The type of people that I associated with were of the same basic philosophy. Everyone was out for what they could get. And I had decided that I wanted to participate in a get-rich-quick scheme, and I decided to lure John Madsen out to the desert and shoot him and use his credit cards to fund this get-rich-quick scheme. It was a plan to grow marijuana out in the wilderness area.
And did you know John Madsen before?
No, ma'am, I did not.
Okay.
How
did you pick him? How did you...
I basically picked him out of a real estate brochure that had his photo because he looked similar to me.
Okay.
And it was during, I would say, the period after I left high school, I drifted away from my parents, what they tried to teach me. And just went off on this path, and it wound up on that Monday day when I lured John Madsen out in the desert and took his life.
And then what else happened?
Well, I dug a shallow grave after I shot him. I put him in it, cover him somewhat, and then drove his car to Sky Harbor Airport where I left it off, and then rented a van near the airport, and then the next day I started this shopping spree using his stolen credit cards. And then after that, I went up into the mountains and started this project to grow this marijuana with the funds and the equipment that I had purchased.
And where was that? Is that near Arizona?
Yes, ma'am, that was in the Montezuma Wilderness area.
Okay.
And about 2 weeks after I was up there, the individual that was my co-conspirator came up there. His job was to come up there every 2 or 3 weeks and resupply me with the foods, the backpacking foods, I thought. And on his first visit up there, he told me the police had been looking for me and calling my parents and everything. And after he left, I decided that I needed to abandon this whole project and come down and face the music, because I had been told that my parents were very worried and very distraught over what had happened.
So you were around 27, you said, at this time. Did you, you know, as you were doing these things, did you think about that you'd get caught, or?
Like most of the people I hung around with, and my own feeling at the time, it was, you know, that would happen to somebody else. You know, I was too clever to get caught. And my co-conspirator was of the same attitude, but after it happened, I mean, the instant after John Madsen died, there was that immediate fear of discovery, of being caught.
So did you take a shovel with you? Did you know, or did you? I mean, was this planned out?
No, this was planned out, ma'am. This was a cold-blooded, premeditated killing.
Okay. So you just tried to cover up, and you took the car to the airport, and that was to try to hide it for as long as possible.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your honesty in telling us what happened. It just helps us to understand, you know, what was your frame of mind at the time? You know, what was going on in your life? Did you ever have a problem with using drugs yourself, or?
I would not say that I was ever addicted to drugs. My drug of choice at the time was marijuana.
Right, so you were
I was a petty dealer at the time, selling it by the ounce, so I had it around me all the time. I smoked joints like most people smoke cigarettes. I would have one in the morning with my coffee, and I'd have one in the evening as a nightcap, and a few in between during the course of the day, because that was a circle that I traveled in. I mean, everybody that I was associated with used in that fashion, but I never got into any hard drugs. I couldn't. And I'm not going to lay the blame at the marijuana. That was a factor. That was part of my lifestyle, ma'am. But the blame lays with turning my back on everything my parents tried to teach me, on just being totally selfish and self-absorbed, of having this sense of entitlement, like the world owed me something when the world didn't owe me a damn thing. And being unwilling to work, unwilling to go to school, unwilling to be productive and carry my own high-limit Visa and MasterCards like Mr. Madsen did. In other words, putting in the work he did to be the success he was before his life was stolen from him.
Okay, well, it sounds like you've had some insights about that while you've been in prison, and you've certainly worked as far as furthering your education. So how would you say, I mean, just for the board members, how would you tell us how you're different today than you were back then?
Well, first and foremost, I believe now and for several years prior to this, I have the attitude of a giver rather than a taker. Back in 1983, and even after I was convicted, I still felt like I was the victim, like the state of Arizona was at fault that I was in prison. It took me a few years to come around to the idea that I had to accept personal responsibility for what I did. And as the time went by, I started taking a harder and more brutal look at myself and what I was. And I didn't like that person. I wanted to change that person. I did not want to continue being the person that I was leading up to and following the few years thereafter the murder of Mr. Matson. And not only what that did to him, what that took away from him, but what that took away from his wife, his four daughters. Man, when I took his life, his oldest daughter, his oldest daughter was 10, and his youngest was an infant. And I believe I don't know exactly the age of the two middle children, but I'm assuming the second youngest was probably a toddler. So these are two people who have no memory whatsoever of their father other than what, you know, their mom or other people who knew him could tell him. And I snatched those away from their lives. And why? Because I wanted to be rich and not work for it. I wanted to have, you know, all the glitz and things that, you know, the whole materialism thing that a lot of people chase after. And that whole attitude cost a man his life and devastated his family.
So, go ahead.
During the time that I reflected on these things, it just developed into a resolve. And it didn't happen overnight. It wasn't instantaneous thing or I can't think of the word right now for it. Instant realization. It happened over a long period of time, just looking and reflecting upon what I had done and what I had taken and what the cost of what I had done was. Then a couple years ago, I attended a class. It was the Impact of Crime on Victims class. And this had a very profound effect on me. Because during the course of this class, every week, a person would come in and take the time out of their lives to talk to us about how a killing of their family member, in most cases a child, usually these were parents, had upon their life. And even though I was able to imagine and contemplate what I had done by myself, you know, just solitary reflection, it did not have the focus, the clarity of seeing firsthand in front of you a person standing up and telling you what it was like for them to lose a loved one. And it's made me determine that I will never again do anything to harm another human being. And I don't just mean anything. I mean, it got me thinking about the words that we use. You know, words can hurt as well as help. And as I go through each day, I don't even want to hurt somebody with words, let alone with actions or doing anything as brutal as what I did back in 1983.
Okay, Mr. Matson, or Mr. Byatt, I mean, I'm sorry. How could you, if we were to prolong you, where could you see yourself in 5 years? What would your life be like in 5 years from now?
In 5 years from now, my goal is to be working. Perhaps, if I'm able to do so through the Veterans Program, to work towards a master's degree in information science. They used to call that library science. I would like, or I see myself living in a small one or two bedroom residence, living simply in Tucson. I see myself volunteering in Tucson for the causes that I think are important to me, that I have a passion for. These include volunteering for the veterans. These include volunteering whenever they have a pledge drive at KUAT at the PBS phone station. Because there I feel a certain indebtedness, because during the course of my incarceration, I've been fortunate enough to enjoy and to learn so many things through PBS. It's been a way of me to kind of leave this place for an hour or two, you know, whether it be something on Nova or whether it be a Masterpiece Theater episode or something, and I want to give back. I don't want to just be one of those people that goes to work, comes back to the house, watches TV. I want to be a part of my community, and I want to give of myself to the community of Tucson, Arizona, where I plan to reside.
Okay, Mr. Weiner, thank you. I'm going to see if fellow board members have any questions for you. Well, Mr. Johnson has a question.
No, I just had one question. I kind of saw in the county attorney's letter. Was this the second time that you attempted to lure in a victim when this incident occurred?
Yes, sir. The first potential victim was set up for a meeting at 6 a.m. on that morning. And he was suspicious and didn't go out to the desert with me. So later that afternoon, after consulting with my co-conspirator, I made another appointment early in the afternoon of March 14th with Mr. Matson's secretary to meet him at the same Denny's restaurant. And he met with me at 6 o'clock that evening and went out to the desert.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
Okay, and that reminds me of a question I had for you. Do you know what happened to your co-conspirator?
No, ma'am, I have no idea where he is or where he went.
Okay, I just didn't
know
if
what became of him.
If you'd heard anything. Okay. Any other questions from board members? No questions. Mr. Fernandez has a question.
Just really quick, Mr. Valle, can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
An important piece of your board hearing notification was the release plans. I heard, and I think that that's very encouraging, that you would seek Social Security assistance and the improved housing. Can you explain to me, based on what you've learned, how the VA housing would work? Should this board ever release you on parole or home arrest?
Yes, sir. I have been accepted at two halfway houses. One of them, the house of my choice, is Old Pueblo Community Services, which has assured a good friend of mine, one of the supporters that's here today, that I've been accepted into one of the two veterans programs that they offer, but they will not be able to tell me which of those two it is until they have a face-to-face interview with me. They are, I am made to understand they work very closely with the VA. They have, and I believe in my presentation packet, on, if you go to number, let's see, it's, here it is, number four. If you go to tab number four, there's a whole listing of their services. The things that I found most appealing to me was their connection with the VA, because I do have some medical issues that I'll have to get with the VA on their copay program to address. One of them is type 2 diabetes. The other is I'm hard of hearing. I'm practically deaf in my left ear. I'm not practically deaf, I guess about 40%, and I've got about maybe 70% hearing in my right ear. But they work closely with the VA. They have job preparation programs. They have life skill classes, because I feel that after being incarcerated for such a long time, I need to relearn my social skills as just, you know, getting around and then and integrating myself. And also, they have someone there, they call them navigators, that will help you transition in terms of using the current technology. I've never used a cell phone, and even though I hear they're very user-friendly, I'm going to want somebody to walk me through it. So Old Pueblo offers all these things, and I've been accepted by them. And when I made my parole plan, I also, just in case I had a plan B, I also got accepted past in house in case for some reason Old Pueblo didn't accept me, though they have. And I've been assured that I am, if I'm granted parole this day, I will be going to Old Pueblo.
Well, thank you, sir. And pardon me, because I was a little fixated on the cover sheet and neglected to review again the really excellent attachment you sent to us. And I did review that. I was just a little tardy fixation on the cover sheet, but that was a really excellent job on your personal package. So thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse.
Sure. Dr. Wright, do you have a question, too?
Yes, ma'am. A statement and question. I think that, you know, in listening to Mr. Biden, he, if I heard him correct, when he was younger, somehow he strayed away from what he had been taught by his family and, I guess, by the community, and he ended up getting involved in this offense, that the initial offense that took place. But I guess one of the things that struck me is the fact that, sir, you have taken such an interest in history and in literature and books and so forth. When did you, and how did you get involved in that? Because apparently as a young person, you just were not involved, per se, but now you fixed on history and literature. So how did that happen, sir?
Actually, sir, it was a return to what I was before I had strayed off of the path that my parents tried to put me on as a child and as a adolescent growing up. I was very fortunate to grow up in a home where my parents, especially my mom, loved reading, and both my parents placed a very high value on education. My mom always used to tell me, son, education is the one thing that you can obtain that no one can ever take from you, no matter what else happens in your life. And when I got incarcerated, when all this happened, I would like to, at this point, state just how fortunate and how grateful I am to have had the parents that I did, because they stuck by me through this whole thing, all the way up until both of their deaths. And throughout the early years of my incarceration, both my parents, as well as a very close friend who's here today, Julie Crutchfield, who, by the way, tried to help me even as early as my trial. I knew her before I got arrested when I attended Scottsdale Community College. And these people stood by me and they encouraged me to pursue an education and to read. And though I had neglected reading after getting out of the Navy and just basically wandering around and making bad choice after bad choice, I came back to it after my incarceration. And reading and education, I think, is what helped get me through this. It's what kept me from, you know, joining the gangs or becoming, you know, just a hardened outlaw. It showed me another path, another possibility of what I could do with my life. And so I wouldn't say that the reading started in prison. I would say that I returned to the reading and I returned to education. And little by little, month by month, and year by year, I returned to those values that my parents tried to teach me, that if I had followed, none of this would have happened and this man would not have lost his life.
Let me just ask one other brief question, sir. I just find, you know, all of us come from have different backgrounds, but I just find it very interesting that you decided that you wanted to become a successful entrepreneur by going out in the desert somewhere and growing marijuana, which was not popular at that time. How did you conclude that that's where you were, that's what you wanted to do? You know, I mean, because you actually got the credit cards, you know, I think you said, to become that entrepreneur and go out in the desert and start growing marijuana and so forth. So how did you come to that conclusion, sir?
I think it was just an offshoot of the lifestyle I was living. I was using the marijuana. I was involved with that subculture at the time. And to my mind, to my twisted way of thinking at that particular time in my life, it just seemed like a natural progression.
Okay.
That's how messed up my head was at.
Okay, sir.
Looking at it now, it just looks like pure idiocy. But back then, as much as I can try to, because I've asked myself, sir, whatever made me do that, whatever made me think along those lines, and that's the best answer I can give you, sir, is just it was probably just a natural progression of kind of the fog I was in at that time in terms of the whole lifestyle I was involved with.
Yeah, finally, I just want to thank you and your supporters for this wonderful document that you put together. It's very comprehensive and it tells us a great deal about you just by reading it and going through it and comprehending it. And thank you again, sir. And thank you so very much, Honorable Miss Rittenhouse.
You are most welcome. Mr. Vaya, we've come to a point in your hearing where we could ask for your supporters to speak. And I've just now noticed that one of your supporters is your attorney. And did you, I'm so sorry, normally we have you come up here and participate, so please do.
Thank you.
I didn't know if you wanted to, it'll be up to Mr. Vaya, you know, would you like your attorney to speak first, or would you like your attorney to, it's up to you, sir.
I would like my attorney to speak whenever he wishes to speak. I'm going to let that be his decision.
Well, there you have it. So we have Mr. Vaya's attorney. Is it Jeffrey Blackman?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and then we have Dr. Becker.
Judith Becker.
Okay, and we have
Natalie Crutchfield.
And Keith White.
Yes.
So if you'd like to determine who would want to come up first, that's fine with us, and then...
Thank you, ma'am. I thought that could have come up if that would be a right.
She could come right up here, and I think, is the green light on in that microphone? I think it is. Okay, perfect.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Becker. Could you just start, please, by stating your name, and then tell us anything you'd like the board to know?
My name is Judith Veronica Becker. I'm a professor emeritus at the University of Arizona. I'm also a licensed psychologist here in our state, and I practice both clinical and forensic psychology.
Very good. So what would you like the board to know about Mr. Raya?
Well, I was retained by Mr. Blackman to do a psychological evaluation and risk assessment. Throughout my career, I've been evaluating and also treating individuals who have committed violent crimes. The majority of them have been sexual crimes, but I also have evaluated and treated individuals who have engaged in other forms of violence. And so over the course of my career, I probably have evaluated thousands of individuals. And so I was asked if I would do a psychological evaluation and risk assessment. So I traveled to Florence and I met with Mr. Baia. I think it was about 5 hours. I could be a little bit off on that. I did what we call a clinical interview, obtaining a lot of background information. And then when we do risk assessments, we focus on, well, I focus on three areas. One has to do with historical factors, and there is actually one of the questions that you asked was, in the past, was there any other history of criminal or violent behavior? The other has to do with clinical factors, because it's not uncommon to find in the background of individuals who have engaged in criminal behavior to have some form of behavioral or mental health problem. Sometimes we see individuals who suffer from bipolar disorder or conduct disorder, or people that have what we call antisocial personality disorder. And then to look at risk factors, because if we're going to intervene with people who have a history of violent or criminal behavior, what we want to know is, what are the factors that put them at risk? Are they aware of those factors? And how can we help them manage those risk factors, if in fact they're motivated to want to manage those risk factors? So I met with Mr. Baia, I evaluated him, formed an opinion, and submitted my report.
All right, and I think we must have something. We must have part.
If it pleases you, ma'am, part one is her evaluation.
Part one. I knew I'd read it somewhere. Just bring up it on paper.
And part two is her CBD.
Do
board members
have any questions for Dr. Becker?
I have a question, Madam Lee, but I would just like to say that I do take note that Dr. Becker, I believe, if I'm reading this correct, did receive her MS from Eastern Washington State College yet, and about 10 years after you received, after you received your master's, I had the opportunity of being employed at that institution. This is something that caught my interest.
Right. I wonder if it, when I was there, it was just one traffic light. Was it like when
it was literally still one traffic light. And there were horses still walking down the street.
It sounds like a great place to go to schools. Mr. Kinnorn's had a chance
to doctor, just a quick question. And I recognize it's probably a bit complicated, but we're listening to Mr. Baia today. He's our articulating himself very well, and he's done a pretty good job of showing accountability in his summary document. When do you think he aren't, so to speak, or when he turned the corner in his life? Because this is a pretty heinous crime. And he's done quite a bit of time in the prison system. People aren't what they were 35 years later, as people evolve, but who do you think accounts for the change in Mr. Ryan?
I think, based on the information that he provided to me and what we heard today, it doesn't seem like it was one of those aha moments. And I mean, having evaluated thousands of people, some of them, you know, say to me, oh my goodness, it's like I got the Lord or I got religion, and you know, that wasn't me, it was because of my parents or because of this, that, or the other. And I always say, well, I think it's very good, you know, that if there's something else that you're looking at or can rely on that might help you through and become a better person. But I think in Mr. Byers' case, I mean, he's a very bright man. And I think sometimes what happens is people look and they say, you know, that road I was on, that path that I was on, it wasn't paying. I mean, look at where I am now. And that way of thinking, you know, there's a quick and easy way of making money. Well, that really didn't work. So I think for him there was the realization that that kind of behavior really doesn't pay, and it didn't pay for him. I think after that, he began to develop some empathy. And I think that that victim impact group, and that really, I'm so glad that we're doing this, one of our institutions, because getting people to have the feeling, to put themselves in the shoes, so to speak, of people who have been their victims, you know, can really impact not only on their thinking, but also on their behavior and their emotions. So I think the way I put it together, you know, is this isn't a life that paid, and this is a life that's not going to be paying in the future. And there's another life that I can have. And then I think the empathy for his victims began to take hold. And we see in his behavior helping other inmates there at the institution, furthering himself in terms of education, the other courses that he took, and his assistance to other inmates.
Well, it goes without saying that none of us are clinicians. And I don't want to use this word loosely, but have you dealt with individuals? You said you've dealt with thousands of people that you would describe as sociopathic or having no empathy?
I wouldn't say I've dealt with thousands of sociopathic, you know, people. But yes, you know, I've dealt with many people, not only in evaluating them, but in treating them and trying to help them develop a sense of empathy. Usually when these people that I've evaluated commit offenses, they're thinking of themselves at the time. You know, they are not saying to themselves, usually what they're saying is, I'm not going to get caught, you know, and I have a right to do what I am doing, this sense of entitlement. And it's only when you talk very often about the impact that their behavior has. For example, there's an assessment instrument that some people use. It's called the psychopathy checklist. One of the questions that we ask is, who do you think has suffered more from your offense? What we're hoping to hear, what I'm hoping to hear as a clinician, is for the person to say, well, I guess the victim and the victim's family. Sometimes what we hear, and I heard from people, is, well, I have. Look at me, I'm arrested, I'm here in jail, I'm here in prison. And so what we're looking for, and empathy is something, you know, that can take time to develop, and it can improve over time. I hope that wasn't too long.
No. Thank you, Mary. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? Mr. Johnson.
I just had one question. It's something that I know that Mr. Rea is a very intelligent man. He didn't have a criminal past. the pre-plan this entire incident due to some circumstances that he did get caught on it. But this was a pre-plan from A to Z, that this was planned out, and it was all planned to make money, as he said, get rich quick scheme. And he did this, but I just wanted to say, should you have talked to him, what is your opinion? Do you think that he's over this type of behavior? Because he's very intelligent, very articulate in how he speaks and what he says. And, you know, he's been doing very well since he's been incarcerated. I'm just kind of making an assumption that prior to this, you know, he was an articulate and very well-spoken person, you know, prior to this happening. So when you had the opportunity to sit down and interview him, did you take any of that into consideration? Or?
Yes, sir. And what I look for is change and consistency over time. Now, within the Department of Corrections, you know, there's opportunity to manipulate guards. There's opportunity to manipulate inmates, to take advantage of people, to be violent, to use drugs, to do all sorts of things that they would rather they not do. But that has not been Mr. Bly's behavior since he has been incarcerated. So he has shown consistent pro-social behavior over a period of 34 years.
Okay, so when a person shows pro-social behavior, do they have a tendency to at some point relapse, or is that just they continue along that line of pro-social behavior, as you call it?
Well, we hope is that they will continue along the line of pro-social behavior, and that's why we look at what were risk factors for them and how to manage those risk factors, either within an institution or outside of an institution. And Mr. Vaya put together a really thorough and good plan,
yes,
in terms of what he hopes his life will be in the community. Even continuing in therapy, you know, while being a counselor, he knows that it's going to be a major change, you know, to be in our community.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions?
Just to jump off, thank you, Mr. Hills. Just to follow up on that too, because with Mr. Johnson's question, that just helped me clarify a question, and that is, as a clinician, how do you determine that someone isn't just saying what they want you to hear? Because I heard you say some things, and almost sounded like, well, we're hoping that they say X, and it's like, well, what if they're following a script? Or what if they're just, they just know to behave while in the system, hoping to get out someday, and then to continue that behavior? So I'm asking for your opinion.
Yeah, and we have to look at that. You know, are they talking the talk, or are they really going to walk, you know, what they're telling us? And that involves, again, consistency, looking at a person's behavior, looking at their record, you know, over a period of time. Because as I mentioned, I've seen people who have come in, perhaps I don't do therapy anymore, but for a first therapy session, and they've said to me, oh, you know, that's over. Never going to do that again. I understand I did wrong, et cetera. And the proof is in the behavior and the consistency of the behavior.
Thank you so much, Dr.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Becker. I appreciate it. I've worked in criminal justice for 35 years or so, and I've heard your name, and I've heard your name with great respect. I mean, you are very well respected, so I'm glad to finally meet you. After all this time. Thanks.
May I ask two questions?
Please.
Judith, we talked about this under the statute 31412. There are two questions.
So, would you just please, I'm sorry, just come up and stay your name, because we're recording these.
I'm going to stay here.
Just state your name first and then ask it.
Do you think there's a substantial probability that William would remain at liberty without violating the law?
I do. Again, you know, part of what I did is called a risk assessment. We never say no risk. At least I never say no risk. But we talk about, you know, low, medium, high, you know, risk. And I think he's at very low risk of ever violating the law. He knows the risk factors and he knows he has a plan to manage them.
The other question is, do you have an opinion as to whether or not his release would be in the best interest of the state of Arizona?
I do, and Mr. Valle has talked about what he plans to do when he leaves. He wants to be employed, he wants to do volunteer work, he wants to continue his education and to help other people to the best of his ability, to kind of wake up, in a sense, for in part the crime.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I'd like to call Astrid along.
Okay. Thank you.
And perhaps it would help more if I would just ask her questions.
If you like, we're just going to like to hear from them. But
okay.
Because it's not a court, so we're not...
Before we do this, I just want to say that I do know this witness personally, but I will not recuse myself. She and I have never discussed this.
Oh, never discussed this case.
Thank
All
you.
Right, thank you, sir.
Yeah, okay. I'll just let her speak.
Sure. And if you just start by stating your name for the record, thank you.
Good morning. I'm Astrid Wong.
Welcome. And what would you like to tell the board?
I actually met Bill... This is what I call him, Mr. Brian Bill, through the mother. And I met the mother through the Republican Women's Club, and that's how I met her, right, because of the Republican Club. And I never knew that she had a son that was incarcerated until she couldn't drive. And she called me up and she said, Astrid, I have something that really needs your help. And can you please come to my house and I need to talk to you privately. So I went over there and she then was crying and was telling me how hard it was for her and her husband. And they basically was living their whole life with this son in prison. And so I told her, I say, sure, you know, I'm a businesswoman and of course I have my own business and I have a husband, but I definitely will take you to prison to see your son. I promise that it will be at foot visits, which is 4 times a year. And before you know it, it's almost 10 years now. And either die, pass away, like 3-5 years ago. And through this time that I met Bill and I had a conversation through the food visit, I found that he is a very kind man, which is really, of course, it really shocked me because that was not what my idea of someone in prison. And through all these times of visits, which is 4 times a year, spending like 4 hours every time, I realized that he really have understand what he did was horrible. And not only that, he since his mother died, every time when I saw him, he was telling me that he's so sorry to put his parents through that. If he would just be listening to his parents' teaching. And in my sense of being a good citizen, I really believe that Bill will be a good citizen when he comes out, because all the experience that he had after this crime is all very, very heart-filling for him to really repent to what he is today. And I just hope that the board will make it as a consideration, since his mother would really be happy because his mother was really waiting for this day. And unfortunately, she didn't make it.
Thank you. Was there any other points that you wanted to...
Astrid, would you please tell the folks about the trust, because you failed to mention that?
Okay. So, I am a real estate broker. So, every time Bill sees me, he realizes what he has done to another real estate broker. And the mother had a house, and when she died, she, of course, I sold the house for her, and right now it's in the trust. But because of all the appeals that the parents put the money, they actually, even though the house is like 40 years old, they still have a $200,000 debt when she died. So whatever left on the house is right now is in the trust, and I am the trustee. So as far as, it's not a lot of money, but it definitely can help Bill to help have his new life for a little while too, before he finds a job.
Astrid, how much is left now to help with Bill?
It's $40,000.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do board members have any questions? No? Thank you so much. Good morning. Welcome. Could you please start by stating your name?
I'm Julie.
Julie, okay.
Julie Crutchfield. I'm a retired college professor. I taught for 36 years at Scottsdale Community College, and in 1983, that's when I met Bill William. Yeah, he enrolled in a couple of my classes. The young man that was in my classes, very different from when I heard him describe what he was going through. It's hard to believe, but I had college students are like that. They're up and running down there. I never saw the look at me, the world, or is on this side of them. I saw a really intelligent, friendly, helpful young man. And when he was arrested, it just took me a very long time to even come to grasp with what was really happening to him. I became very close friends with his mother and his father, wonderful people who just supported him and loved him so much. And I helped his mom go on home from visits for a long time before I retired and moved away, and wonderful Astrid has taken over and really helped. I have seen so much growth in this young man in 35 years. I've known him, I've visited him over all these years, and it's just amazing that he has not only come so far, but he is so remorseful for what he did. I don't think a day ever goes by that he doesn't realize, what was I thinking? He's an outstanding young man. I have personally spoken on the phone to Sally Ramsey twice now. Sally is the director, I don't know, I have her in my notes, but I didn't bring them, but she is with the VA, and she works with the Placement in the Pueblo program. They have two programs, one is probationary, and one is just the regular, and she couldn't tell me which one he will fit into yet until she personally interviews him and sees what, you know, his qualifications and everything are going to be, but there's a fabulous opportunity for him there. And I see nothing but positive growth ahead for him. What an outstanding young man. While he was in prison, he taught many of, he worked in a program teaching many of the other, especially ESL, English as a second language, to many of the inmates. Just had a very good record while he was in prison, just helping. And I see that come through. Being a teacher, I just love the fact now that he's always loved books. He reads everything he can get his hands on. And I think he would make a wonderful author. And I hope he pursues that. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you. Thanks for coming today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, just a few things.
Okay, just start by stating your name, please.
This is Jeffrey Blackman. Okay. I'm just going to as a attorney. I was hired on Google last December. I have talked to him several times on the telephone. I visited him twice in person. I reviewed the court file of records in Maricopa County. And together, he and I put together the packet that you folks were provided with. The things I would like to highlight that he had a discharge under honorable conditions. I'd like to let the board know that I have been in phone contact with Sally Ramsey, the manager of Old Pueblo, probably every other week on the phone since the beginning of the year. I spoke to her last week. She assured me that Mr. Baia does have a place to live. And just like Julie just said, where he will fit in and how it will go would not be determined until he actually got there. But she did ask me when I spoke to her, I think it was last Thursday, to please call her today and let her know what your folks' decision is. I know that the one thing Mr. Baia asked me, if I would ask you folks, if you look in the packet, he wrote a letter to Mrs. Manson. She is the widow of the victim. And he wanted to know if you folks would give him an opportunity to read that to you. I think that's at the heart of all of this, that this man truly is sorry for what he did. So I'm wondering if he could have an opportunity to read that.
He can. I mean, we have the letter and we've all read it. We read all this material before we get here.
Can you read it?
Yes.
Billy, you still want to read the letter?
I would be happy to if the board would like me to do so.
Sure. Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Dear Mrs. Madsen, I am compelled by my conscience to reach out to you and express my deep regret for the terrible crime I committed against your husband, John, for what I took from you, and for the pain I caused you. I regret, with much sorrow and shame, the senseless, inexcusable act I committed against your husband when I callously robbed him of his life. I am ashamed and reproachful for the wrongs I did to you, your four daughters, John's mother, his brothers, and all those who worked with, knew, and loved your husband. I have reflected often over the years about the pain and devastation my acts brought to you and your family. The far-reaching consequences of my actions have been haunting me for over 30 years. I caused you such unnecessary hardship, having to raise your four daughters alone without a father to share and lighten that serious responsibility. I also robbed you of all those proud, joyful, and tender moments that parents share while raising their children. I caused you the loneliness and yearning that accompanies not having a husband, a partner, a friend with whom to share life and face its challenges. I have realized over time the many far-reaching ramifications of what I did. So many lives were affected and diminished and worsened because of me. I am heartsick over all the misery I caused. What makes murder such a terrible crime is its finality. It generates an utter inability to undo it or to make amends. I would never dare to ask for nor expect to receive your forgiveness. I ask only that you be aware of the regret, shame, and contrition I carry with me and will continue to carry with me through my remaining days. Please know, Mrs. Madsen, that when I think of your husband, it is with a deep sadness and regret for the life I stole from him and the heartache borne by you and your daughters and all who have suffered because of his absence.
Thank you.
And folks, the only thing I would like to add is under the statute, there are two questions. Is it likely to commit a crime? Would it benefit the state to set him free? I'm not a psychologist, but I trust Judith Becker, and she believes that if Bill Pryor is released, we don't have to worry about him doing anything illegal. As far as benefiting the state, I believe he's intelligent. He'll do everything he can to get a good job. He's going to want to do lots of volunteer work. I've let him know that I am there as a resource if he wants to call me. These other folks are here as resources, including Mr. White, who I didn't call as a witness. He served a long time. We can't bring Mr. Madsen back. But while Bill is still relatively young and is employable and has good health, I'm hoping you folks will give him a chance of being a free man, improving not just to you, but to society, that he can be a worthwhile member. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Did Mr. White want to speak as well? Okay.
My name is Keith White. First of all, I have utmost respect for the board members here. I know Bill Villa personally for doing time with Bill. Met Bill in 1984 in Central Unit. Married in the chapel. He was a part of religious services. In 2007, I was released from prison. I was doing time for a capital offense, as Bill is. I did 25 years and 20 days. I was released from home arrest. I'm absolute discharge. I'm a civil rights restorer. I've had gainful employment since I've been out. And I just recently started my own business that is doing very, very well. I came here today because I've been in contact with Bill after I was off parole. I reached out to Bill. And we've been in mail correspondence. We played basketball together, went to church together. Played baseball together, and we socialized together. But one thing that I want to share with the board today is when you're in prison, I came from a life of crime, drug addiction, and hanging with the wrong crowd. I can blame that all on the wrong crowd, but I took my responsibility for my responsibility in the crime that I was convicted with, just as Bill is today. But in prison, we hung with the group that was like-minded. Biblically speaking, Apostle Paul talks about being like-minded. Being like-minded, having the same goals and the same outlook in life. Bill is, of five people, I can probably count on my hand that I would walk into my home now that I'm released and would entrust him to meet my wife. Bill is one of those five people that I've, out of 25 years of people that I met in prison. Prison has its own social society apart from this society. And I consider Will a friend. He has a lot of property I have in my storage shed that I want to get back into his house once he gets to his halfway house or wherever he's going to be released, if the board should grant that today. But I'm going to be very instrumental support part of Bill's life. My wife, I met her in 1991 when I was in East Unit in Florence. We got married in 1991. Well, I met her in 1987. We got married in 1991. Been with her ever since. We own our own house in South Scottsdale. She works for the airline. And I'm a success story, but Bill is also a success story. I wouldn't have hung with Bill in prison if he wouldn't have been like-minded as me. On the same focus in life where we recognized what we did to our crime, the victims that we left behind. I partook of that class that Bill talked about, victims' rights, where the victims came in and spoke to us and we realized the depth, because you never know the depth until you're facing the person that's been a victim. You can imagine in your mind how difficult it would be. But nothing is as raw as when you're sitting in front of a victim and what they went through. I came from a good family, from a farming background in Iowa. My mom and dad were church-going people. I brought a lot of shame and hurt upon my family, just as Bill did upon his family. He lost both of his parents. Both of my parents are still alive today. But there's been a reconciliation with my family, me and my dad, my mom, and the rest of my siblings. Bill has lost both of his parents, but he has a support group here today that will do whatever they can to assist Bill in this transition. And I know you both members have a lot, a big responsibility today. I wouldn't want your job. But in the mindset of where Bill is today, his remorse, he's taking accountability for his crime, I hope that you would find a favorable vote for his release. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Mr. White? Questions? Thanks. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Vaya, we're coming up on the end of your hearing, and I want to give you the opportunity. You've heard everything that's been said. Is there anything else that you would like the board to consider that you haven't already stated? And then we'll also give you your attorney opportunity if there's anything else that either of you have thought of that that the board should know or consider.
Yes, ma'am. I would first like to thank all those who presented themselves here today on my behalf, gave of their time out of their busy schedules. I also want to thank each of you board members for your time. And what I would like to add is that I no longer feel a sense of entitlement. I don't feel like I have earned parole this day or that it should be something that is coming to me. If parole is granted to me this day, whatever the form, home arrest, general, whatever you decide, I will see it as a very precious gift, a gift not to be squandered, something that I will cherish and that I will go and wake up every single morning and throughout every single day proving that if given this opportunity that you would not regret it. And that each and every day I will do something positive for my community and for those I interact with. Whether it's the people I encounter riding on SunTram to and from work or at work or in my volunteer efforts or in the neighborhood, every day I will be a good neighbor, a good friend, a good member of the community that is productive and beneficial to that community. That is my daily goal each and every day. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Ryan. Sir, did you want to add anything? Or?
I would just like to thank the five of you for giving him such a fair hearing. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Vaya, the board is going to go into discussion. We do all of our discussion in public under the Arizona Open Meeting Law. So we've not discussed your case. We've each reviewed our files individually, but we've not discussed that as a board until this moment. So as our discussion is in public, everyone present will hear it, including you. So please just stay on the phone and just remain silent, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, sir. The board is now in discussion. Mr. Vaya is an individual who, as I am seeing him, has truly come to grips in his mind with what he's done. I hear remorse. I hear a very insightful explanation of how he was when the crime originally occurred and how he is now and how he is different. I think he has very good insight into his own thought processes and why he did the things he did. I think he has a good support system. He's got several of them here today. He's got He's improved, he's bettered himself by pursuing education. He is, has used a phrase that I particularly like, which he said, I was a taker and now I'm going to be a giver. I'm going to give back, and he's talked about doing volunteer work and et cetera. I noted when Mr. Beyer received his parole, his previous parole, 412B, he only had one hearing and was granted. And ordinarily, when someone comes before the board for the first time, they really, you know, it takes a while for them to think of what they need to present to the board. In Mr. Vaya's case, he's put together a very comprehensive packet. So I, you know, based on what I've heard today, based on the support of his, the individuals that are here today, I can definitely see Mr. Vaya as a good candidate. The tricky thing here is going to be the residence, because if we grant home arrest, the individual has to have a place to go. Now, we have an acceptance letter, but it doesn't exactly say, it's kind of a form letter. So that would be my only concern. Now, we could also grant general parole to that. So I'm open now to discussion from board members, I think. I'd like to hear what you all think about this. Mr. Johnson.
Hi. Mr. Mayor has done an excellent job with PACA. He has excellent support out there. I just tell you, I do have a little bit of concern about these just, has everything together that he could. This is together like he planned the crime that he committed. He planned the crime that he committed to a T the same way. So I think the psychologist says that he has, pro-social behavior, that he's done well, and that his pro-social behavior has shown that his tendency is to not go, you know, in that direction and commit crime. So I think that that would have been my only concern. But I think I just gave a good explanation and explained it very well.
Okay, so any other thoughts? Mr. Gideon?
I don't think what I have to say is much different. Like we all often say, we don't want to forget that there were victims and that this was a very serious capital crime. We don't have anyone to represent the victims today. But at the end of the day, when I look at the totality of the case, you know, there's a question for me as to whether or not, on behalf of the people of Arizona, we can safely transition this individual back to the community. And I like to see success stories, and I think Mr. Vaya certainly has potential. Like you, Ms. Rittenhouse, I'm a little concerned about the residents back there. Because I would be a bigger, for the lack of a better word, fan of home arrest as opposed to going directly to general parole.
Okay.
And we just don't have a solid address.
Okay.
I think that if we want to go to home arrest route, I think we could do it as we used to do it, and that is that it would be at the discretion of the parole officer, and if they can't find one, then they will come back to us.
Uh-huh.
I think that would be one way that we could get around that one.
If it's suitable,
if it's acceptable to the board.
Okay. All right. Doug Wayne, did you have any other comments?
No, I think that he's an impressive person. He thinks well, and he thinks through everything. You know, sometimes you ask the question in your own mind: Is he that good, or is he put on the show for the board? I think that he's proved himself that he can be a successful person out in the community, and I feel that we ought to give him that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Any comments?
Well, I agree with Dr. White on the home arrest. better before, and, you know, we had people, you know, they weren't successful, but they came back in front of us, and the evil ones were successful, and you say, okay, here's your own rest. But they're not released for 2 months because they have what they call the arrangements, and that happens, they won't run out the door until the arrangement's made. And in this case, where the VA wants a face-to-face with him, if they know he's getting out the door, it might be arranged at the facility just before he's released, so they make that differentiation. Or they can release him to a PO that will place him in another halfway house while they're doing the interviews and the final question and all the work. So I think it's time for Mr. Ryan to move forward with his life and actually put to practice a lot of what he's learned.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. All right, based on then everything that we've heard today, I'm going to make a motion that we grant home arrest, which is home arrest, and deny general parole and absolute discharge to Mr. William Bayon.
Second?
Agreed.
Okay, motion by myself, seconded Mr. Neal. Agreed, Dr. White, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Quinones. Grant, I have to mark some. Release tip granted is home arrest. And then conditions of home arrest. Follow all mandatory corrections, conditions and sanctions. Probably needs assessment referral, I would say. No alcohol use. Random tests for drugs and alcohol, which I would say that's at the parole officer's discretion, which could, you know, maybe start and then be discontinued after the PO is satisfied that that is not an issue. I'm going to say may not operate a motor vehicle. Mr. Bryan himself mentioned taking Suntran, so I think he's probably aware of cars are quite different now than they were a long time ago. And
parole officer discretion.
Yeah, parole officer discretion, let's just say. Because after he's out of it, he might. Okay. We didn't discuss restitution. It was mentioned in the pre-sentence investigation, but in the sentencing documents, there's not a peep about it. So I'll just say must pay if applicable. Abide by institution rules because, and I know Mr. Vai is listening, so when you're on home arrest, you're still essentially an inmate, so you must still abide by the rules. Partake in available programming as directed and no contact with the victim or victim's families. There's a supervision fee that starts after 60 days. 60, 90?
60.
And it's $65 per month. And as far as housing, we will say El Pueblo Community Services or as established by the parole officers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to write that on here. Pueblo or as established by PO. All right,
and then there's a release to 2 months. That his trustee has indicated that he has $40,000 left.
So we'll say, I'll just make a note, funds available. Available. Okay, somebody can read this. For first 2 months. And the Department of Corrections requires that 2 months worth of funding is available for housing and such. And you've indicated that is available. So. Okay, so Mr. Vaya, the board has voted unanimously to grant home arrest to you, and you heard the conditions. Do you need me to repeat them, or You were the, you'll get this all.
I will get a copy, right?
You'll get a list of all the requirements.
Yes, ma'am.
And that will, you know, the department, we can work with your CO3. The department will take some time to out-process you. It won't be instant. It'll take a couple of weeks. And maybe even as much as a couple of months, as Mr. Neal said, while you have your interview with the VA and get your housing established and et cetera. So.
Excuse me, ma'am. Could I say something to address that real briefly?
Sure.
Okay. As far as I know, pending, of course, a parole officer's approval, I will definitely be going to Old Pueblo. Now, they have multiple halfway houses, so I don't know the exact address.
Yes.
The other thing, the gentleman, I'm sorry, sir, I forgot your name, but you're sitting to the left of Dr. Wright.
Mr. Neal.
Mentioned going, Dr. Neal?
Mr. Neal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Neal mentioned, well, he might go to a halfway house in the meantime while he waits for his interview with Old Pueblo. I did, in fact, get accepted and have a housing deposit with Paxton House.
Okay.
And Paxton House is run by Leah Jones and her husband, who were previous co-directors of Old Pueblo. And even though they recommended me to go to Old Pueblo because they have the programs that are better suited for me and everything that are veterans related, she was more than willing to have her halfway house serve as a fallback position. So that speaks to what Mr. Neal said. Also, my parole eligibility date isn't until November 9th, so I've got between now and then to make those arrangements as well.
Good. Okay. All right, sir. So thank you, Mr. Blackman. Thank you.
I'm hoping you can explain to me, so I understand. I understand the concept of home release, and I understand there's a date in November where he will be actually freed. As he just said, he's been accepted at two different places. Between now and when he's released, will someone from parole contact him?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
To do an interview?
They will contact him as soon as the paperwork is there. He will be contacted and he can get that information to you immediately.
Okay, and then they will determine whether they want him.
They will determine. The parole office will determine, will make that determination. They will take everything from there. We're out of it. It will be he and the parole officer.
Okay.
We will work on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So thanks to everyone for participating. Mr. Vial, good luck to you because the world has changed quite a bit. And good luck with learning cell phones and cars and all those things. But
thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. And we'll see you again in about, about 6 months after you're released from home arrest. We'll see how you're doing. Only you'll be here this time, that time. You won't be on the video anymore. You'll be here in person.
Okay, ma'am, could I say one final thing?
Please.
I give you my word, all five of you, I will not let you down. You will not regret your decision this day.
Well, that's good to hear, sir. Thank you. Good luck. Best to everyone, and thanks for participating today. And your hearing's concluded.
And the board will now take a 5-minute recess.